First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
More young people in Florida continue to get sick and sometimes die from coronavirus. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a student death in St. John's County renews calls for masks in that district's schools. Give us a call and your voice to the conversation. It's 549-2937. Then later, an eviction crisis is looming in the state. We'll tell you who's stepping up to help both landlords and tenants. But first this hour, Duval County Public Schools began its mask mandate for all students Tuesday. Duval has joined districts across the state in defying an executive order from the governor on masks for kids. Meanwhile, the debate over face masks in the St. John's County schools is still being fought after a student at Pedro Menendez High School died last week, doctors say, from complications tied to COVID-19. We begin the hour with Mobeen Rathore, MD, one of the leading pediatricians speaking out on this in our area. He's chief of infectious diseases and immunology at Wilson Children's and chair of infection prevention at Baptist Health. Dr. Rathore, always good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Glad to be here.
Already getting your calls as we talk about the student death at Pedro Menendez High School. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInjax. Dr. Rathore, we have not gotten confirmation from the St. John's County schools that a 17-year-old Menendez student died of COVID-19 complications. However, you have already publicly said that's what happened. Is that right?
Well, that's the information that's in the public domain. I don't have any personal information on this. This was what was reported in the media.
Okay. And so you and other pediatricians for months now have been advocating for masks in schools. Duval County began a mask mandate district-wide yesterday. You now need a doctor's note to opt your student out of wearing a mask in school if you send them to a Duval County public school. Nassau County, other counties are masking up students. There's a court battle still going on about this because the governor has banned mask mandates in schools. We are not yet seeing a mandate in St. John's County. However, there was a board workshop Tuesday, and the superintendent there said that cases are skyrocketing in St. John's and that they might have to temporarily transition to virtual learning. What are your thoughts?
Well, Melissa, first of all, masks work. We need to use masks in our school system to protect our children. Duval County has had more than almost 2,200 cases of coronavirus identified, of which more than 1,900 are in students. And this is probably just the tip of the iceberg. There are probably many other children who are infected. We just don't know about it. As you know, sometimes children can be asymptomatic. And, of course, that's causing quarantine for many other children. You know, even if the child in St. John's County did not die of COVID-19, are we waiting for children to die of COVID-19 before we are going to take this disease seriously and mask up our children? I mean, who's responsible for a child dying of COVID-19 if they get the infection in school? I think we need to ask those challenging and difficult questions. And as a community, we need to rally to protect our children.
549-2937, can you talk about what you're seeing in pediatric hospitals right now when it comes to children who are sick?
Yeah, so as you know, we overall in our community, fortunately, we have passed the peak of the fourth surge and we are plateauing at a lower level. Unfortunately, in children, we are still seeing a large number of infected children being admitted to the hospital, and that's not surprising since there are a large number of children infected in the community. And, we have our peak was 22 cases, 21 I'm 22 children in one day, but we have been tutoring around 17, 18, 19, 20. So we have not really seen that decrease in this significant sustained decrease in the surge as we have seen in the adult population. Now, I want to give you a sobering statistic. In the first 18 months of the pandemic in Northeast Florida, there were 3 deaths that in children. That's one death every 6 months. In the last 2 months, July and August, there were 4 deaths. That's 2 deaths per month. So, you know, I think if anybody has this idea that coronavirus is not a serious illness in children, I think that, that just that statistic should tell you something. In addition, July and August have been our worst months for children being admitted to the hospital by, you know, at least a double. The previous worst month was January of this year.
It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Dr. Rathore, here's a story that caught my eye. In Israel, what they have done is distribute home COVID tests to parents so that more students can stay in school. Really simple concept. If your child tests positive, you keep your child home. If not, you send your kid to school. It's preventing quarantines, and it's keeping more kids in class. The education ministry in Israel distributed nearly 2 million home test kits to parents of kids in grades K through 9. They can't force parents to do it. They recommend it. But if your child tests positive, you just keep them at home. Making test kits more easily available to parents. That seems like a good idea.
Yeah, I think testing, tracking, and tracing of not just children, but the community for coronavirus infection is a good idea. Unfortunately, the home test that we have available in the United States at this time is not that great. And we believe it if it's positive. We still would like to get it confirmed by the by a molecular test. But a negative test does not mean the child is not infected. I think here's the important thing. If your child in Duval County, in Northeast Florida, if your child or anybody in your household is sick with what looks like an upper respiratory tract infection, they may very well have COVID-19 infection, and I think they should be tested. And if even if the person they are exposed to is not proven to be infected, the chances are they could be infected. Anybody who's exposed to somebody who's infected should be tested. The tests are free, and I think we should get them done. And if you suspect that your child or if yourself you're going to work, that you may have coronavirus because of the symptoms, you should stay home before you get tested. And once you get tested and proven to be not infected, then, of course, you can go to school or home. So you're absolutely correct. Increased, enhanced testing is a critical part of the mitigating processes for prevention of infection in our schools. But that has to go hand in hand with get all those who are eligible to get vaccinated, get the vaccine, and masking, social distancing, all the things we have talked about before.
We'll go to your calls in a moment, particularly from St. John's County. It's 549-2937. Now, Dr. Rathore, as I mentioned, this is a very divisive issue everywhere, but especially in St. John's County, where the board has declined to institute a mask mandate. In Duval County, meanwhile, the mandate began yesterday. DCPS has surpassed 2,000 COVID cases, Duval County Public Schools. It's hoped the mandate will bring that number down. What are your thoughts about the way we're seeing a different approach county by county to this public health crisis?
Well, Melissa, I don't know when in our society protecting our children became a divisive issue. I mean, think about it. You know, what we're talking about is protect our children. That should be a no-brainer. Everyone should be for protecting our children. So I think process of protecting our children, in, among other things, includes masking. I mean, I think if you are a parent who has a child cannot get the vaccine, or somebody in your household cannot get the vaccine, the best way you can do that is, which is right now children less than 12 years of age, what best thing you can do is make sure everybody around them is vaccinated, make sure everybody around them is masked. You should demand that. It's your child. And same thing you should demand at schools. And I think we need to cocoon these children who cannot be vaccinated by making sure everybody around them is not infected by vaccination, by if they get infected by masking and social distancing. So I feel sad that protecting our children is a divisive issue now.
549-2937. Give us a call. Mel in St. Augustine. Hi, Mel. We'll start with you. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Last Friday night at Sound City High School's football game, they had a moment of silence for Deputy Sheriff Resource Officer, who also died of COVID. So my question to the school board and the anti-mask crowd is how many deaths are acceptable before we take common sense measures to limit this?
Thanks, Mel. Yeah, you know, first responders have been hit particularly hard by this virus, Dr. Rathor, and that's tragic to see as well.
Well, I mean, people who are there to protect our communities, whether it's the first responders, healthcare workers, you know, we are all struggling. We want to do what's right, and we will continue to do what's right to protect and help our community. But it's not only getting sad that we have to lose first responders to these infections, but it's also getting a little bit tiring for everybody now. This is not easy to see people sick and dying of something that we know can be prevented. I mean, it's not that people are getting tired of taking care of patients or first responders are getting tired of caring for the who need their response. It's that when you know that, gosh, this could be prevented, this doesn't have to be like this. I think that's what's really causing stress to the community who's there to help those who are sick.
And we're getting lots of calls from parents. Anne in St. John's. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I have two students who are go to St. John's County Schools, and we've actually already had one sent home due to exposure. But luckily, I keep her mask, and I have gotten her vaccinated, so she came back negative, thank goodness. But my other child, who can't get the vaccine, she's suffering from anxiety because her classmates are not masking, and she's afraid to bring the COVID virus back home and make us sick.
Yeah.
It's like putting a Band-Aid on a open, wide wound by only having adults wear masks. It's extremely frustrating.
Anne, thank you. Yes, Dr. Rathor, the superintendent and the school board in St. John's have mandated masks for adults, teachers, and staff, but not students. And so particularly for parents like Anne, who have kids who are still too young to be vaccinated, they have a lot of anxiety right now.
Yeah, and I think these are smart kids. They know what's right, and they feel, they are sometimes smarter than us adults. And they feel the pressure. This causes the mental health stress. Some of them are going to have PTSD because they have to go to school every day. And then they, knowing that they can get infected, then they hear about this possible death possibly from coronavirus. And can you imagine what that makes them feel like? Can you imagine a kid being at school for several hours and knows that my student sitting next to me can give me the infection and I could get very sick? That's a serious mental health issue. You mentioned something that I need to also address. You said that in St. John's public school system, the adults are supposed to wear the mask, but not children. You know, I hate to say that, but that's illogical. This is an equal opportunity infector, this virus. It does not discriminate by age. Think about this. If, you know, half the people on the road were asked to follow the traffic rules and other half not, and, you know, it will be a really tragic drive to work if somebody, you know, drives through a red light and hits our cars. This is not something you can pick and choose. Everybody has to be masked. Every eligible person for vaccine should get vaccinated. So I think doing it piecemeal is really a recipe for disaster.
Katrina in St. John's County. Hi, Katrina.
Hi. I'm a parent of a student that goes to the school in St. John's County with the highest infection rate in the county. We're a K-8 school. And one of the things that we're really struggling with is contact tracing. The school's kind of abdicated that responsibility to the Department of Health. So we're not finding out as parents till 3-4 days later that our children have been exposed to a classmate that has tested positive for COVID. And by that time, they've already been in the classroom for an extra 4 days where they may have already been sick and they have not been able to get tested. We've actually taken to Facebook, and most of the schools have self-reporting groups on there. So we as parents can let each other know when our children have tested positive. And this is only increasing the speed in which COVID is running through our schools.
Thanks, Katrina. You know, we've heard from so many parents about that problem. Dr. Rithor, I believe the schools are required to go through the health department, and there certainly has been some criticism of how quickly the DOH is getting this data back. What do you think could be done to improve this situation?
Well, I think something, you know, the parents are doing, this crowdsourcing, you know, is really going to be helpful. But I think I have to say that the contact tracing should be done by the health department. They are the experts in them. They have done it for years, for decades, for other infections. I'm not necessarily opposed to them doing that. They have to work in collaboration, of course, with the school system. And the Department of Health needs resources. I think this is important. I think she brings up a very good point. If somebody has been exposed to an individual with infection, and it takes 4 days before you know about contact tracing, and there are other children who are infected in that 4 days and are now infecting other people and exposing other children, that's not the best way to do it. I have to come back to the same thing. If all the eligible children were immunized and adults were immunized and everybody was masked, the risk of transmission of infection decreases significantly.
Let me follow up on that. When do you anticipate that the vaccination age will be lowered for parents of children under 12 who are anxiously waiting on that?
I wish that it was yesterday, but I think it's going to take a little while. The conventional wisdom was before Thanksgiving. There is some hope that FDA is trying to put more resources into it, and we may get it approved at the beginning of November. Sometime like that. But there's a process. I think it's extremely important for your audience to understand. We want the FDA to do its due diligence. I know we all want the vaccine. I want it more than the next person. But we also want FDA to do its due diligence, as it did with approving the vaccine for the adults. So I think we have to be patient. I don't think so we have a choice. But there is a lot of pressure, I would use the word, on FDA to put more resources, not to make shortcuts. I want to make that very clear. FDA is not going to take any shortcuts, but they're going to put more resources that perhaps the evaluation could be completed sooner and the vaccine could be made available sooner.
Lots of calls as we speak with Mobeen Rathore, Chief of Infectious Diseases and Immunology at Wolfson Children's Hospital, and he also chairs infection prevention with Baptist Health. As a student in St. John's County is now dead from complications related to coronavirus. So many calls from parents out there. Don, on the line in St. John's County. Hi, Don. How are you?
How are you today?
Okay, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I believe that there's no way or nowhere to run. I think that us as a collective body, as human beings, have to understand that our immune systems are battling right now. There's been various diseases in history and everything with human beings. I don't believe that a virus can destroy us as a nation. And I think that our food sources have to be a little bit corrected.
Well, I agree with you on that, Don, but we want to keep the topic to masks in schools because that's what we invited the doctor on to talk about.
I was always interested in having my son having a mask on. I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm not anti-mask. But I understand that there's certain liters of oxygen that the body must have in order for this engine to produce.
Okay,
like
Don.
A car.
Don. Thanks for the call. Lots of calls. Chris in Clay County. Go ahead. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a 3-year-old in daycare. Also got a 5-month-old, and I'm just wondering why aren't daycare workers mandated to wear masks? like, you know, me and my wife are both vaccinated, but we're sitting here looking at her daycare, and they're just sitting around, not wearing them.
I think it depends on, you know, I think it just depends on the individual company you go to, because there is no statewide order. It's up to the discretion of each company. For example, Chris, here at WJCT Public Media, we've been under a mask mandate since March of 2020. People coming into this building for a year and a half now have to wear a mask. So, unfortunately, it depends on where you send your kids.
Yeah, I mean, I sit with my mask on all day at work. My wife does the same, but they're working with children, like young children, cannot get the vaccine at all.
Right. Like, and I can...
It should be, yeah.
Yeah, and I understand your concern. And so, Chris, thank you, Dr. Rathore. I'm sure you've heard these kinds of comments from parents who have young children in daycare. And what are your thoughts about Chris's situation?
Yeah, I think Chris brings up a very important point. I think, again, I will go back to what I said. We as parents, especially a five-month-old and a four-year-old who's not even going to be eligible for vaccination, even when the ages decrease to 6 years and older, and hopefully by November, they need to demand the same thing. They need to, you know, like-minded parents need to get together and say, we want to send our kids to childcare centers that require masking for the adults. We know the American Academy of Pediatrics is on record on this. We know that children 2 years and older can easily put on the mask. You know, parents need to model that. So I think, again, this is something we need to cocoon these children who are at risk. You know, we are actually, as you know, Melissa, doing a study for children 6 months to less than 6 years of age to see the vaccine approved for them also. But that's going to take a while. But let me just say, address one thing that your previous caller, Don, said. Don is correct. We have had infections throughout the millennia, and it's not going to destroy us as a nation. It's going to cause a lot of misery. It's going to cause a lot of death. It's going to cause a lot of work hours. It's going to cause lots of other things. You know, if we just assume that we can not worry about it because it won't destroy us, well, you know, that's not the way we did for polio or for smallpox or, you know, measles. We don't let these infections cause misery on our population.
At least we didn't in the past. I mean, not to this degree. Although I will say, you know, when you research the flu pandemic of 100 years ago, there were lots of Americans that didn't like masks, although it was really the only tool that people had. And there were certainly resistance to mask mandates even 100 years ago to tamp down deaths from the deadly flu pandemic of 1918, that era. Stephen in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Stephen. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. So just a real practical question here, you know, for the doctor. So I have a first grader, you know, in a local school here. You know, of course, kids go outside and play in recess. My kid happens to do that multiple times a day. So, you know, what is the thought with what kids are doing with their masks at that point? So some parents want their kids to wear masks outside all day. I'll go to the playground. I'll see, you know, my kid out there, you know, without a mask on. Some of them have them wrapped around their chin. You know, some of them are dropping them in the dirt or they're putting them in their pocket. You know, how sanitary is that at the end of the day? If they're not wearing masks outside, you know, what are the teachers doing with the masks in the meantime? Are they putting each individual mask like in a paper bag for the student to get when they come back into the classroom? Or are they keeping the mask somewhere in the classroom and then all the kids are rushing back in all hot and sweaty and, of course, not social distancing? Just really my question is one of practicality. How practical is it for kids to, one, wear masks all day long, or two, if they are wearing masks all day long and then taking them off and putting them in their pocket and whatnot, are we really preventing any spread of disease?
Thanks, Stephen. These are practical questions, Doctor, that a lot of parents have. And certainly parents opposed to universal masking in schools say that the Parents' Bill of Rights, which was passed by the state, gives them the right to opt their child out. So, okay, so what about Stephen's questions?
Okay. First of all, yes, parents' rights are important, but you shouldn't forget that children also have rights, and they have right to have a safe environment, safe school, right not to get sick, and right not to die because senselessly because of an infection that can be prevented. To Stephen's question, yeah, I mean, you cannot 100% of the time enforce some things. You know, we as parents, we always worry about what our children are doing, even though we tell them, we model for them, we explain to them. Also remember, in the open, the chances of transmission are much less than in a closed environment. So where we go to school, where we work, where we play, or we pray in congregations, those places when you are in closed environments, the risk of transmission is much higher. Now, in terms of the cleanliness and sanitization of the mask, you heard me say this before, Melissa. You won't send your child to school with dirty underwear. Why would you send them with a dirty mask? You know, wash their mask, give them a facial covering, and have them go there if it's not clean. So, yeah, Stephen makes a good point. It's a logical thing. If we cannot have, if the kid is at school for 4 hours, 30 minutes of that is in school for 5 hours, and 30 minutes of that is in recess or other places where they may take off their mask, well, that's only 20% of the time. We are still protecting them 80% of the time. We are decreasing the risk by 80%. Now, I hope most children, we can educate and model for them that they should and can wear masks all the time.
Lots of tweets, meanwhile, for Dr. Mobeen Rathore of Wolfson and Baptist. Jesse tweets the show, I'm scared for my grandchildren that attend a public elementary school in St. John's. They wear their masks, but they are surrounded by those who don't. A tweet from a listener in Jacksonville, an unmasked child at Duval County Public Schools Jacks Beach Elementary School infected my child with COVID. 7 of the 21 kids in class were opted out of masks by parents. At least 2 kids in the class are now COVID positive. The class is now shut down and online only. That happened, I would guess, before the mask mandate went into effect, which was yesterday. Pam tweets the show, I'm a teacher in Duval that had to quarantine for 10 days due to getting COVID from a student. But my students weren't quarantined, only me. How does that stop the spread? Here's a tweet from Robin. If your child tests positive and has COVID, how do you take care of them at home? Are they supposed to be in quarantine at home so no one else gets sick? Dr. Rathore, theoretically, if anyone tests positive, child or adult, they are supposed to quarantine, although not everyone's probably following that. What's your advice?
You're right. I think we have good guidelines from the CDC and the U.S. Department of Health. If you are exposed or you're infected, you need to be quarantined. I mean, there's no two things about that. And let me just say, you know, Jessie said that she's scared for her grandchild. I would be too. If I know that my child is not being protected because of others not wanting to wear masks. So, all these various tweets, they are difficult, challenging, practical issues, but they can have to be addressed on an individualized basis. There's not a one-fits-all situation here. So, yeah, I mean, I get those questions all the time, and we try to individualize them.
Helen in St. Augustine. Helen, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. I really appreciate Dr. Rathore's comments. As the mother of 2 girls in St. John's County, we've seen so much with masks and without masks, and he's making it so very plain, but unfortunately, and this is just my comment, that this school district is playing roulette with the lives of our children as they cater to DeSantis's political agenda and aspirations. And it's the children who are suffering, the children who are getting sick, the families who have anxiety. I have an immunocompromised child in this district, and every day we're constantly getting them tested weekly, and every day we're worried that she'll bring something home and wind up back at Wolfson's as she was last year. So, you know, when we're trying to toe the line between politics and the lives of our children and the safety of our families, it's really a dangerous game that he's playing. Thank you for your time.
Helen, thanks. Dr. Rathore, do you and other pediatricians plan to go back to the St. John's County School Board, as you have done in the past, to speak and encourage them to change their policy?
You know, pediatricians have been advocating for mask mandates in schools. The American Academy of Pediatrics, representing 67,000 pediatricians, says that. the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, representing more than 2,500 pediatricians in Florida, has said that, the Northeast Florida Pediatric Society has said that, individual pediatricians have said that, we will keep advocating. You know, I don't have children, school-age children in the school system right now. That doesn't mean I don't care for children. I mean, I and many other pediatricians have spent our professional careers advocating for what's important for children. And this is important for children. So we will be there when we are needed for our children. We want to be remembered. We as a nation, when people are looking back 50, 100 years ago, 100 years from now, looking back, I want them to be able to say, you know what? Americans were great in protecting our children when they were most needed, and not to say we let our children get sick and die because you were simply not wanting to wear a mask.
Dr. Mobeen Rathore, affiliated with Wolfson's Baptist and also UF Health, always good to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Melissa. Keep up the good work, please.
And much more still ahead later. Some positive news and notes from the week. It's our What's Good Wednesdays, but up next.
The legal community is uniquely positioned to help tenants and landlords and the community to volunteer time and talents, of course, because the court system is the one that's going to be dealing with this backlog of evictions.
We'll tell you who's doing their part to help Florida renters and landlords caught up in this month's looming eviction crisis. That's next. Well, the end of the eviction moratorium in America is sparking an eviction crisis this month. Millions of Americans could soon be thrown out of their homes, despite billions that's been allocated in federal aid to prevent just this catastrophe. But here's some good news. Local attorneys are stepping up and trying to lend a hand to help people, both tenants and landlords. I spoke about this with local attorney Mike Freed. He's president of the National Conference of Bar Presidents. Here's that conversation. So, Mike, thanks for being with us. And tell us about this action, this call from the National Conference of Bar Presidents, what you're hoping that the legal community can do about the eviction crisis.
Yeah, I mean, the legal community is uniquely positioned to help tenants and landlords and the community volunteer time and talents, of course, and the court system, because the court system is the one that's going to be, you know, dealing with this backlog of evictions. And there's practical ways to resolve things. There's a lot of money that the federal government has placed in play to help make landlords whole and keep tenants in place. And so it's really a great opportunity for the legal community to do what it often does and step up and fill that gap.
Right. $46 billion in federal rental assistance funds, but a lot of it isn't getting where it needs to go. So how do you see your role in all of that?
Yeah, I mean, it varies. And of course, I'm speaking as the president of the National Conference of Bar Presidents. So it varies jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Every city, every state has a different protocol, a different statutory regime, things they can do and can't do. But you're absolutely right. It's a matter of communication. And just breaking that logjam, because the federal government stepped up and said, we realize that when people are displaced from homes, that hurts everybody. It hurts the property owners, many of whom are not, you know, huge conglomerates. They're just small people, you know, individuals like you and me that may just happen to be renting out a house. And it obviously affects the kids in a mental health capacity, having to be displaced, maybe even becoming homeless. So communities suffer, families suffer for generations to come. So the resources are there, the money's there, and the legal community can help in each jurisdiction to break that logjam and help advise people on what they need to do.
So you're calling on local law firms, bar association leaders, a lawyer hanging out their own shingle. Anyone in the legal world within the sound of your voice right now, you're saying, needs to get involved. How can they get involved?
Yeah, and the best thing to do really is to perhaps start by calling your local legal aid organization. The bar should be doing what I believe the Jacksonville Bar Association is a good example of, and that is seeing how they can help. Jacksonville Bar Association last year helped to facilitate the distribution of the first round of funds. But, you know, there's some great models out there. Texas has a model where there's lawyers that are actually volunteering their time to set up free clinics in the courthouses because the volume of these proceedings are quite substantial. So just a couple of hours, you know, a month per lawyer, even just, a nice group of lawyers can really make a difference. And it's not something that's uncommon for the legal community. We are, you know, either required or strongly suggested, depending on where you're a member of the bar, to volunteer time because that's what it means to be part of a profession.
So contact them. And I want to thank you, Mike Fried. He's with the Gunster firm in Jacksonville, and he's also president of the National Conference of Bar Presidents. Always good to speak with you. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa. Appreciate it.
Well, as we discussed earlier in the program, mask mandates are now uniform this week across the Duval County Public Schools. It's giving comfort to many parents concerned about transmission of coronavirus in their child's classroom. Meanwhile, there are other concerns about air filtration in school buildings and whether those systems are sufficient to protect against COVID-19. Environmental engineer Rich Rice is part of the Duval Pandemic Solutions team, and he's also the parent of a child in a local elementary school. Rice got permission from that school to install upgraded filtration in his son's class. I spoke with him, and here's that conversation. So, Rich, tell me a little bit about your area of expertise with these kinds of systems and how they improve air quality indoors.
Sure. I don't purport to be an infectious disease expert, biochemist, or public health specialist. I'm just an environmental engineer with bioenvironmental engineering and bioresource engineering degrees. Most of my career has actually been spent on remediating and preventing hazardous substance spills to the environment.
Sure. So you have knowledge of this, and using official sources, you attempted to get the Duval schools to install a certain kind of system within classrooms to better protect kids and teachers from COVID-19. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, generally, I was concerned that the Duval County Public School District was not implementing the layered approach of public health mitigation measures recommended by the CDC. And as a result, our teachers and our children and school staff are at an unnecessarily higher risk of transmission of SARS-CoV-2, which I'll just refer to as coronavirus.
You decided to take it upon yourself to protect your son, given your expertise. Can you tell me what
Yes.
you did?
Well, I first requested the status of the filtration and ventilation in the classroom. And I did not receive responses that suggested that it was being provided in accordance with the guidance document. So he had an issue in the class where he was exposed to one of the kids, and that led to some other problems. So what I tried to do is take matters into my own hands and improve the indoor air quality in his room to the extent that I could. So what I did was I followed the guidance and recommendations in the various guidance documents to create a MERV 13 box fan filter.
What is that?
So it probably is good to start with a little bit about filters. So the filtration levels are classified as minimum efficiency reporting values, or MERV, which is a scaled rating of the effectiveness of air filters. And it's designed to represent the worst-case performance of a filter when you're dealing with particles in the range of 0.3 to 1, 1 to 3, and 3 to 10 micrometers. And according to ASHRAE's technical resources on filtration and disinfection, the particle size of the virus is around 0.1 micrometers. So to give listeners an idea of how small that is, the California Academy of Sciences estimates that you can put 15,000 virus particles on the head of a pin. However, the virus doesn't travel on its own, which they describe as naked. In other words, it's always attached to something. And since it's human-generated, the virus is trapped in respiratory droplets and droplet nuclei, which is a dry respiratory droplet, that are predominantly 1 micrometer in size or larger. And so ASHRAE recommends using a minimum MERV-13 filter, which is 85% efficient at capturing particles within that range, which is considered the particle of concern range.
And so
you
obtain permission from your son's elementary school to install this in his classroom. And only his classroom, even though what you had hoped was to have the entire county school system do something like this, right?
Yes, I requested from the assistant superintendent of operations, and I've had communications with him and administrators and the school board. And
the school system basically said, no, you can't do that, but we will let you do that in your son's classroom. We're not going to install this kind of thing system-wide, but you can go in and do this in your son's classroom, right?
Well, I just haven't gotten responses. They didn't say no, but I just recently received approval from the principal at my son's school. Like I said, he had these panic attacks recently, and so... You know, my son's aware of the risks. He understands virus transmission. He observes this irrational school setting and is fixating on the feeling of the breath on his neck. And, and so I can't tell him with a straight face everything's okay. Because like I said, it's not.
It's not. Do you feel like after doing this that he is a little more comfortable? Are you more comfortable?
No, I'm not more comfortable. As I was saying, the administrative controls that are recommended are not in place at his school, and very limited data set checking on other schools suggests it's also not in place there. And based on conversations that I've had with the school board and some of the administrators, the filtration system is not currently installed in accordance with or operated in accordance with guidance documents.
So, Lynn, let me ask you, Rich, what in an ideal world, what do you think the Duval County Public Schools should do in this matter to make the air filtration system safer for the human beings that are in these buildings right now?
Well, there needs to be upgrades from the current MERV 8 filter that's being used throughout the school system. It needs to be upgraded to MERV 13, which is what ASHRAE recommends and what the Harvard Healthy Buildings recommends and Johns Hopkins School of Public Health recommends.
That was Rich Rice of the Duval Pandemic Solutions Team. We have reached out to the Duval County Public Schools for comment, and we'll have that as soon as possible. In a moment, some good news for your week. That's next.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com. Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community, featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com.
On the next Fresh Air, We remember Michael K. Williams, who died Monday. We'll listen back to our interviews with him. He co-starred in The Wire, Boardwalk Empire, The Night Of, and When They See Us, and is nominated for an Emmy for his performance in Lovecraft Country. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robin Young. Acclaimed singer-songwriter Josh Ritter has a new novel, a rollicking ride about a boy coming of age in a logging camp in the 1900s, a story the songwriter said he just had to write.
Getting the song out of your head, you have to sing it to get it out, and it's the same with writing, I find.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Somewhere there a mountain's top of snow. Somewhere where the wildflowers grow.
In the coming days, California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom will face voters in a recall election. California has only successfully recalled a governor once in 2003. But the outcome of this recall has potential ramifications far beyond the Golden State. We'll find out why next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, a long-standing women's surfing competition is coming to Jacksonville Beach this fall. The Supergirl Surf Pro Contest has taken place in San Diego for 15 years. This is the first time it's riding waves on the East Coast. Surfer and Jacks Beach native Kayla Durden says she's looking forward to competing in her hometown.
For the first time, our town is going to be considered, you know, a world-class, world-qualifying series event location. And all these girls are going to be coming here and kind of getting to see, like, what we work with and, you know, where we live and kind of how we train, because we're always going out there. So I think it'll really change the culture for East Coast surfers.
Now, Durden says learning to surf on smaller, warmer waves in Florida has given her a different skill set.
Florida surfers are a little bit better at generating speed and kind of maneuvering smaller, kind of weaker surf. So I actually think coming in on my turf in my hometown, I definitely have a bit of an advantage.
The Supergirl Surf Pro Contest takes place November 12th through the 14th. It's free, so come enjoy it at the beach. Well, the pandemic has meant the end for scores of eating and drinking establishments across the state. In Tallahassee, Tom Flanagan reports at least one such place featuring coffee and cats actually saw its business pick up.
The Tally Cat Cafe in a small North Monroe Street strip center is co-owned by Katie Logue. She says her traffic actually went up while COVID raged.
People have been so stressed with the pandemic, they're also looking for spaces that they can go and sort of decompress, relax, and this is a prime candidate for that sort of thing.
So much so that Logue says the Tally Cat Cafe has adopted out 1,000 cats since it first opened in May of 2018. When it became the city's second cat cafe in operation.
1,000 adoption celebration is probably just what we're going to go forth and call it.
A celebration that she says will include a formal event soon. The Tally Cat Cafe is affiliated with the Leon County Humane Society. I'm Tom Flanagan.
And here's some more good news for your middle of the week. We're going to lead off What's Good Wednesdays with exciting news about this region's lush tree canopy. Guess what? It's growing. Greenscape of Jacksonville and the Jacksonville Equestrian Center are holding a ribbon-cutting ceremony tomorrow, celebrating the planting of 101 trees there under the recently formed Tree Commission. Now, this commission oversees mitigation funds paid to the city of Jacksonville by developers, so that they can try to compensate for trees that are removed when buildings go up. These new trees will provide shade at the outdoor arenas at the Equestrian Center and to the horses and their owners camped on the grounds. Well, do you like to sing? The North Florida Women's Chorale is auditioning new members, and they're rehearsing for a performance, Jubilate, that will be held on December 5th. They'll be joined by the Gainesville Brass Quintet, too. If you'd like to join this vibrant group of female singers, go to womenschorale.org and ask for an audition. Well, what started with just a handful of donors a few weeks ago has turned into a wide-ranging effort, raising thousands to feed hospital workers on the front lines of COVID in our area. Last night, the Rotary Club of Ponte Vedra, along with clubs in Palm Valley and Ponte Vedra Beach, and two different Pieology restaurants. They all got together to deliver dozens of pizzas to hundreds of hospital workers at Baptist Medical Center Beaches. It's the biggest meal delivery yet in the Rotary Club's Feed the Frontline campaign. They started this in collaboration with One Jacks at UNF a few weeks ago, and they've been working just to give a shout out to frontline healthcare workers. Getting a good meal in between the labor has been hard for them. So kudos, folks, and keep that effort going. A Classic Theater is launching its new season with a wide range of plays unique to the St. John's area. They produce full productions of large and small cast plays, and they perform in the historic Lincolnville neighborhood. You can get tickets to the new season at aclassictheater.org. They're going to kick things off with Lullaby of Broadway, some classic music in that production. That's nice to see. And if you've got some good news to share, drop us a line. We'll try to mention it on Wednesday mornings. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Our senior producer is Heather Schatz. Associate producer Catherine Hobbs and director Josh Torres round out this outstanding team. Thanks also to editorial director Jessica Palumbo. Now, as I said, got some good news or any news, any feedback you'd like to send our way, drop us an email. Send it to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, you can catch our podcast. It's up later today on all platforms. You can also always listen to all of our great radio content and even watch some good TV, too, right through the WJCT app. Download it today. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.